The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The State Department says, look, he was doing this in his personal capacity and there were no taxpayer resources used. But that's just really hard to understand. I mean, the Secretary of State is the Secretary of State 24 hours a day. Plus, he was on an official trip overseas. You know, just simply getting there required government aircraft. Being on that rooftop in Jerusalem, no doubt, gave diplomatic security a lot of work to do. It's just hard to understand why they think that they can say he was doing this in his personal capacity and, you know, the U.S. taxpayers weren't paying for it. But that's all they're saying. They're not saying, oh, and legally we decided these rules didn't apply to him. They just aren't answering that question.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 28th, 2020. In mid-May, President Trump fired the State Department Inspector General Steve Linnick. The ouster came as a surprise, and although it is clear that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo asked Trump to fire him, the reasons Pompeo gave for it have changed over time. This is just one of a series of controversies coming out of the Department of State in recent months. With the House Foreign Affairs Committee investigating and additional Inspector General reports becoming public, I sat down with Politico's Foreign Affairs correspondent Nihal Tusi and Scott Anderson, my fellow senior editor at Lawfare, to sort through it all. Among other things, we talked about the implications of Secretary Pompeo's speech at the Republican National Convention, the IG's report on Pompeo's controversial decision to declare an emergency to expedite the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia, questions about the use of department resources in support of Susan Pompeo, and the State Department's responses to the House and Senate requests for documents related to Biden and Burisma. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 28th. What's going on at Pompeo's State Department? With Nihal Tusi and Scott Anderson. So Nihal and Scott, we have a lot to cover today regarding what's sort of going on at the State Department. I want to start with a very sort of discreet incident that's been all over the news this week, and that is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's speech that he gave this week as part of the Republican National Convention. I think it's as good a place as any for a jumping off point for talking about the issues we'll talk about today. Nihal, you've really been kind of a tour de force on all of these issues, and you specifically wrote a piece for Politico about this. Why don't you walk us through sort of what happened and also what you know about the House congressional investigation that the House Democrats have announced on this topic in particular?
Certainly. So Secretary Pompeo did something that, you know, most secretaries of state, certainly in modern decades, have not done. He made an appearance at the Republican National Convention, which is basically, it's a partisan event. And traditionally, secretaries of state have avoided attending partisan events, or in this case, you know, sending a message to them, because the idea has been that this sort of internal domestic politics stops at the water's edge and that the Secretary of State is supposed to speak for the entire country, not just one political party. But Pompeo, he's really a very partisan guy in many ways and has been for a long time. And he's been pushing the envelope on this sort of stuff for quite a while. He's made appearances at other events, including the Conservative Political Action Conference, that made me, like, months ago, ask the question, is he going to show up to the Republican National Convention? And so he did. And, you know, what makes this extra interesting, though, this time around, is that he just, you know, a few months ago, he approved some updated guidelines for everybody at the State Department, including Senate-confirmed presidential appointees like himself, that were very, very restrictive about the sorts of partisan political activities people can engage in. And there's a line in one of these memos that I obtained that flat out says that people like Pompeo, Senate-confirmed presidential appointees, cannot even attend a political convention. And so this is a policy at the State Department. It's not really law, but there's also the Hatch Act, which governs federal employees and limits their political activity. And so Pompeo's people have been making claims or saying, oh, you know, he did this entirely in his personal capacity when he was in Jerusalem. But the thing is, people say, look, he was there by taking a government aircraft. There's no time when the Secretary of State isn't the Secretary of State. And so Democrats on the Hill are investigating this now. They want to know if he violated, you know, any laws, including the Hatch Act, but also, you know, if he violated the policies that he himself has been promoting for the State Department.
That's really useful. And I think it sets up nicely. Scott, you wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post with our colleague, Susan Hennessy, kind of about the implications of Secretary Pompeo's decision, not only to do the speech, but to do it in the particular way that he did. Talk to us about some your piece that you did, and also, you know, the extent to which this is or is not a legal issue. To what extent is it more about norms?
Absolutely. There really are two sets of principles that are at issue here, both of which have kind of a normative component and then a legal or sort of policy component. One is the general restrictions that government employees are supposed to employ that separates their official work from their political views or any political participation or speech they may engage in. That's the sort of thing we associate with the Hatch Act, although it actually goes beyond that. There are other policy measures, as Nihal had mentioned, that different agencies adopt. There are rules about how you use appropriated funds when you're dealing with political candidates who are also office holders, things like that. And so there's a whole set of rules around that set of principles. For the State Department, there's then a second set of rules or principles that are embodied in State Department regulations, and they're actually pretty unique to the department. And that is a pretty bright line rule that says U.S. diplomats, when they're overseas, and actually their family members as well, are basically not supposed to be expressing any sort of political views or engaged in any sort of partisan behavior whatsoever. This has been a rule that's been on the books in State Department regulations since 2003, although it really reflects a set of practices that have been in place even longer than that, before that, at least as kind of more informal norms. And it's pretty unequivocal. And the memorandum that Nihal mentioned, which was also reemphasized in a cable that Secretary Pompeo sent to every post in the world, meaning every embassy, every State Department employee, received this cable outlining these principles on July 24th. So just a few weeks before Secretary Pompeo chose to go against that guidance and record a very clearly partisan statement on this trip to Jerusalem to take advantage of the roof of the King David and Hotel, which has this amazing view of the old city that he was trying to capture and project the position on Jerusalem being a major victory of the Trump administration policy-wise. The real issue that Susan and I hit on in that is that there are legal arguments about the extent to which these things apply to senior officials in different ways. Certainly, the State Department policy doesn't really have any exceptions in it, but it's embedded in the Foreign Affairs Manual, the State Department regs, and the secretary has a lot of capacity to enact changes or amendments or exceptions to those rules, because a lot of those rules kind of are promulgated under his authority in the first place. The Hatch Act also has certain exceptions about, well, if you insulate yourself by not using government funds, by doing things in your personal capacity, there's an argument that some of it might be okay, although it's tricky and it walks a line there, certainly. But the bigger issue here is that even if this doesn't fall under the technical letter of the law, there's a broader principle underlying these restrictions about why they're important. And the basic idea is that you need to keep officials' duties separate from their partisan beliefs so that you can both guarantee that nobody is confused about that public servants serve the entirety of the American public, not just one partisan part of it. And so that foreign audiences, foreign officials, people diplomats engage in, get the same message that these diplomats are speaking for the whole country, not just one partisan sect or faction. And that principle is really what the secretary undermined here. He really went against guidance that he himself had signed off on, and that even the lowest level employees in the State Department, the unpaid interns, are expected to abide by when they're overseas in some capacity. Again, even the family members, the kids, the wives of overseas diplomats are not supposed to be engaging in partisan behavior of any sort. The restrictions are actually much more severe than are available or that are imposed on other government employees. That itself is kind of problematic. I've actually got a piece that hopefully will be up shortly on that, looking at those policies and why those raise kind of constitutional and policy questions in and of themselves. But nonetheless, if there are problems with those policies, that doesn't make it right for the secretary to ignore them in his own capacity and leave them in place for everybody else.
And if I could just add one thing on this. You know, yes, the policies are especially strict for diplomats who are overseas, which Pompeo was at the time that he recorded this message to the RNC. But they're also pretty strict for the diplomats and State Department employees who are in the United States. And from my read of the memos, there was no exception made for people like Pompeo, you know, again, Senate-confirmed presidential appointee, even when he's in the U.S., to show up at one of these events. So it's, you know, it does sort of matter on location, but when it comes to the secretary himself, as far as we know, unless he literally changed the policy himself in the last few days and hasn't told us, there's really no exception for him.
And Nihal, you know, based on your reporting, you obviously hear from a lot of people, like, what is the explanation for him signing off on those policies, but then going against them? I mean, is it really just kind of, you know, this policy is for all of thee, but not for me? Or is there some justification or theory that you've heard?
They have not given us the legal rationale. One of the things that the Democrats on the Hill want is the actual legal analysis that these lawyers who are said to have vetted Pompeo's appearance and speech have come up with. We don't know on what grounds they decided that this was going to be okay. Now, at the same time, the State Department says, look, he was doing this in his personal capacity, and there were no taxpayer resources used. But that's just really hard to understand. I mean, the Secretary of State is the Secretary of State 24 hours a day. Plus, he was on an official trip overseas. You know, just simply getting there required government aircraft. Being on that rooftop in Jerusalem, no doubt, gave diplomatic security a lot of work to do. It's just hard to understand why they think that they can say he was doing this in his personal capacity and you know, the U.S. taxpayers weren't paying for it. But that's all they're saying. They're not saying, oh, and legally we decided these rules didn't apply to him. They just aren't answering that question.
So I want to get back to the House Foreign Affairs Committee investigations a little bit later in the podcast. But right now I want to go back in time a little bit for, you know, further certainly than this week, way back to May of this year, to the firing of State Department Inspector General Steve Linnick. Our listeners will be very familiar with the function that inspectors general perform in the agencies. These individuals are nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate. So they are executive branch employees, and they can be basically fired by the president. But the role that they're supposed to perform in the agencies is essentially as an independent watchdog within the agency. So, you know, Linnick was fired in May. From an outsider's perspective, it came on quite suddenly. And I just would note before, Nihal, I ask you a question, you know, the broader context, of course, and our listeners will know this as well, is that Trump has fired four of these inspectors general in less than 2 months, basically. And President Trump, when he talked about this firing of Linnick, tried to sort of act like it was a normal thing that other presidents have done. And his spokesperson, Kelly McEnany, also made some misleading statements about it. But the reality is that since 2000, actually, President Obama is the only president to remove an inspector general. He removed one. So it is quite unusual. But first, I want to focus here on sorting through the confusion that was certainly in the press initially about why Steve Linnick was fired. I think reporting has established that it was basically at the behest of Secretary of State Pompeo that Trump did, you know, fire Linnick. But there were several different rationales put forward by different people about different underlying incidents that have, you know, since come to light. So Nahal, if you could, you've done a lot of reporting on these issues. Can you sort of walk us through how this unfolded and also the facts as we understand them now about why Linick was fired?
Sure. I mean, it was pretty late at night when I got the call from a colleague saying that Linick was being fired. We managed to confirm it. And to be really honest, like even now, it still seems like a surprise. So look, there is this grander issue of this administration not really respecting norms when it comes to watchdogs and not really being keen on responding to demands for accountability. You know, whether it's the impeachment investigators who wanted documents that the administration, including the State Department, never gave them, or any number of other things. So you have that in the background. Now, what ended up coming out, you know, starting that night in mid-May, was that Linick has, his office has been investigating Pompeo on a couple of things. One of them was the role Pompeo played in declaring an emergency to sell Saudis weapons, despite what people in Congress wanted. So that's one thing. But the inspector general also was investigating whether Pompeo and his wife, Susan, have been improperly using taxpayer resources. You know, the examples we're hearing are like, you know, using an aide to run an errand or something. But, you know, the sense I get is that there might be bigger issues with that. So that was happening. And then Trump and Pompeo, they have admitted that Pompeo was the one who asked Trump to fire Linick. So we know that happened. Pompeo insists that he did not know that Linick was investigating him or his wife. And that's a tricky one that's been a little hard to believe. We know Linick has said that he informed top aides to Pompeo, including the Deputy Secretary of State, that he was investigating the Secretary of State. And the idea that none of these top aides told the Secretary of State that he and his wife were under investigation by the Inspector General is, well, it's pretty shocking. So this was happening. Pompeo says that had nothing to do with it. I didn't even know I was under investigation for this stuff. The reason he has given for firing Linick has, frankly, like, it's varied. At first, he just said he wasn't on board with the State Department mission. He wasn't doing his job. Very vague terms and kind of one that seeks, you know, suggests some ignorance that the State Department Inspector General is supposed to be independent. And he's not necessarily going to, like, Pompeo complained that Linick wasn't, you know, pushing this ethos statement for the State Department that Pompeo had come up with. And that's not really what the Inspector General is supposed to do. That's just one example they gave. Pompeo and his people also complained that there were leaks that they believe came from Linick's office in terms of past Inspector General reports. But Linick has pointed out that, you know, he had an outside investigator look into that and that they found no evidence that anyone in his office was behind those leaks. And then in the months since, Pompeo has come up with other rationales. He's, you know, said Linick was a bad actor. He said that Linick, the morale in his office was low. He said Linick wasn't doing a very good job, that he wasn't doing enough auditing of some of the taxpayer spending. It's all been very vague and confusing. And when I talk to sources at the department, sometimes they're like, we genuinely don't know where Pompeo is getting these allegations from. Like this idea that Linick wasn't doing enough audits. They're like, we don't know what he's talking about. Where is he seeing this? So the rationale has not been clear. It's been quite vague and it's sort of evolved and they keep trying to throw new things at it as people demand explanations. And I think maybe part of this was that Pompeo didn't realize that, you know, so many people were going to be looking into this and that people would be willing to talk because from what I can tell, there's a lot of people unhappy that this happened.
Scott, I want to dig a little deeper into the first thing that Nahal mentioned, which is the Saudi arms sales. And in particular, as we understand from press reporting, and you've written about this, the Inspector General was looking at the process through which the department, Pompeo in particular, and his aides sort of went through to justify an emergency declaration in order to essentially bypass congressional approval, sort of informal process of congressional approval of the arms sales. Dig in a little deeper for us on that. What happened? Why were there these machinations about an emergency justification? And what did IG Linick find about that?
Yeah. So to understand this particular part of the IG's work, you do have to take a step back and look at the Arms Export Control Act, which is the law that governs arms sales for the United States that the State Department primarily administers in coordination with the Defense Department. It essentially has a process in place where the agencies, particularly the State Department, have to provide advance notice for certain arms sales, but generally larger arms sales, significant arms sales, to members of Congress to give Congress an opportunity to try and enact legislation that would stop them, to block them, essentially. But there's a problem with that legislation as written, or at least the way it's implemented now, which is that at some point it relied upon a tool called a legislative veto that would have allowed a simple majority to block arms sales in Congress. That was later found unconstitutional. So now to actually block an arms sales in Congress, the Congress would actually have to enact a law, which presumably would be vetoed by the president who's trying to complete the arms sales, and then override the president's veto with two-thirds support, a really high threshold that Congress does not produce very often. In part because of that, the emphasis has shifted away from that formal legal mechanism towards a more informal mechanism, where several administrations basically come to relevant congressional officials, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committees, and the ranking members primarily, and say in advance of providing the formal notification, here is an informal heads up for you about what we're planning to submit in X number of days. And there's actually like the Obama administration went through and reformulated this to have a more predictable timeline and things along those lines. And it gives those ranking members the opportunities to put informal holds on those arms sales really more or less indefinitely. But it's kind of this game of chicken between the two sides. The authority that the ranking member has to impose that holds only holds out so long as the executive branch complies with the norm, is willing to continue playing this game, because it's not actually legally enforceable in any way, because the law itself doesn't require that. It only requires a formal notification. And the formal notification just provides a fixed period by which Congress can try and enact one of these laws, and it usually is almost guaranteed not to work, and then the arms sale is able to go through. What happened in this case is that the Trump administration and Secretary Pompeo had gotten very frustrated, or so it appears at least, with holds that were put on a number of arms sales to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, as well as they ended up lumping it in with some sales to Jordan as well, but primarily really the ones to UAE and Saudi Arabia that had been held up over objections over the Khashoggi killing and over the conflict in Yemen that those two states have really been the driving forces behind. And so what ended up happening is that they were looking, and this is what the IG report covers, they were looking for some sort of legal mechanism that would allow them to get around this hold. And what they settled on is this emergency provision that, when it's invoked by the secretary, allows the agency to bypass the formal statutory notification period. And then that is also taken to mean that they can bypass the informal notification period because, well, they're not providing notice. So there's no reason they need to provide informal advance notice of the notice, the formal notice they're going to be providing. So they invoke this emergency waiver, and they allow these 23 arms sales, 15, I think, of which had been held up by prior holds already, to proceed on the basis of there being an emergency. Congress did object. They actually did enact resolutions trying to block those arms sales, joint resolutions with bipartisan support. But as is predictable at this point, they were vetoed by the president, never went anywhere. And the arms sales have gone forward in practice. The contracts have gone forward, although the IG's report noted that very little of it has actually been delivered as of late 2019 when they were looking at this investigation. And it's not clear much has been delivered since then. But some items have begun to flow in these arms sales. What the IG report really found is that, first, they didn't find anything legally wrong with the emergency certification, the way the secretary used it. And again, that's because the law is written in kind of a pretty deferential way, and in a way that the real emphasis, the thing they're trying to avoid, was an informal practice that precedes the formal practice in the law. So in this case, they said essentially this emergency certification was done pursuant to a delegation that was in the law. And that's kind of the extent to which they evaluate its legality, because the language in the statute is pretty broad, and those sorts of things tend to be given, the executive branch tends to receive pretty broad discretion when invoking broadly worded statutes in the foreign affairs, national security context. But they did criticize the Secretary Pompeo in particular for failing to take measures to better evaluate and mitigate civilian casualties that have been arising from the use of arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, specifically in the Yemen context, which has been a recurring concern by a variety of parties that U.S. arms sales are being used in ways that are killing civilians. They pointed out that several standing U.S. policies indicate that measures should be taken to prevent this from happening, and they criticize the department for not taking those steps adequately in pushing forward these arms sales.
So, I hear you on all of that, and I think your assessment is right. My question for you, and Nihal, if you have views on this too, I mean, as you described it, Scott, there was a legal mechanism for the department to get the arms sales through without declaring an emergency. It was just to send up the notification and wait the 30 days. And it seems to me that wouldn't have garnered Secretary Pompeo and the State Department the kind of blowback they've gotten regarding this emergency declaration, which a lot of people on the Hill saw as sort of something that was ginned up. Why is it that the department decided to go this sort of emergency route as opposed to just essentially blowing through the hold and waiting the 30 days, which would have been totally within legally and wouldn't really have been questioned as a legal matter?
Well, I think the thing you have to bear in mind here is the importance of the informal process that I mentioned before to the kind of balance of power between Congress and the executive in this area. The assumption has always been that Congress can restrict the president's ability to engage in these arms sales. In fact, the president, it's not clear, has any inherent constitutional authority to do so. The United States has done arms sales almost throughout its entire history, but it's always been pursuant to congressional authorization. Actually, the first Congress enacted a law allowing George Washington to pursue arms sales in various cases. And so it's always been the statutory authority that Congress can restrict. Right now, we have this Arms Export Control Act that gives the president a huge amount of discretion in pursuing arms sales, but it's contingent upon these notification provisions. And the concern of prior administrations has always been, well, look, if we stop complying with this informal norm process we've negotiated, Congress will restrict our authority and take it away from us. And they will put in something much more onerous for us to pursue these arms sales. And in fact, we think these arms sales are good for U.S. national security. The calculus on the part of Pompeo and the people who helped him formulate this plan appears to have been that if we just ignore the informal holds and move forward with this formal notification in 30 days, that is the death of this informal process. And therefore, anything else that comes after it may change the Arms Export Control Act. Congress may change Arms Export Control Act to strip away that authority. Maybe there'll be something else in play that will make it harder for them to appropriate monies or otherwise put big obstacles in the road for future arms sales. So instead, they kind of tried to have it both ways. In their statement, they actually, explaining and invoking the emergency waiver, they actually said expressly, we consider this a one-time thing. This doesn't impact our overall informal process, what's often called tiered notification. This doesn't impact that at all. That is all going to continue as normal for all other sales. This is a one-time thing because of these very vaguely described and not particularly credible emergency circumstances that are in this case. Folks on the Hill didn't necessarily buy that. They did object to this kind of stripping of congressional authority. And while they'd spent a lot of time talking about the emergency invocation, really the real issue is that they're bypassing congressional input through whatever mechanisms that have been had before, both through the informal and through the formal process. And it's worth noting that we've seen Secretary Pompeo and his State Department more recently float the possibility of doing away with the informal notification process altogether, saying we're not going to do this informal game anymore. If Congress is going to change Arms Export Control Act, change the Arms Export Control Act, really taking that final step that they would have done if they had just ignored these informal waivers instead of using this excuse of this emergency certification to do so in more of an exceptional one-off way. But we haven't seen that trial balloon go anywhere yet. And I kind of suspect we won't, at least before the election, because it is an issue that actually has a constituency of Republicans, particularly in the Senate, that they care a lot about. We actually saw Senator Graham, Lindsey Graham, who's generally a pretty strong supporter of the administration, come out around the time of this emergency certification and say expressly, the president's abusing his authority and Congress should take steps to rein it in this case. Pretty bold statement. And so I suspect that idea would get substantial pushback from the Republican caucus. Now, is that enough that they actually would enact changes to the Arms Export Control Act over President Trump's veto, as would almost certainly be necessary? Maybe not, probably not, but it's at least a fight that the Trump administration doesn't seem eager to have right now.
One thing I wanted to also add is that the way that the State Department released the Inspector General's report, or at least treated it, was really, really striking. For one thing, the State Department, the higher-ups, Pompeo's people, insisted that the version that is posted to the public has some redaction on it, but they did send an unredacted version to Congress. And those redactions make a huge amount of difference when you understand the whole thing. For instance, the redacted version makes it look like in a span of, 3 days, there was something came up and Pompeo, briefed Congress on a potential emergency, apparently involving Iran. And, the paperwork was sent 2 days later and certified. And then the emergency declaration was declared on May 24th. So within like 3 days, it looks in this version of the report like that's what happened. But the unredacted version, which I managed to obtain, shows that actually they were talking at the State Department about having an emergency declaration as a workaround to get these arms sales through as early as April 3rd. So this was like, 6-7 weeks before they actually declared the emergency. So when you look at the unredacted version, you realize, what kind of an emergency was this? If you guys already were planning it and it took that long to get it through, and why did you try to hide it from the public? One other thing that was super fascinating was usually the State Department Inspector General releases the reports through their own office. Again, it's a mark of the office's independence. But the day before they did so, the State Department, Pompeo's people, held a background briefing for reporters. And they were like, yeah, we just want to let you guys know that the report that's going to be coming out totally exonerates Secretary Pompeo, says he did nothing wrong. They quoted like three little pieces from the report that basically we found out later said, technically he was within his legal rights. And they, they give us this to the reporters, and we're on the background call and we're just like, wait a minute, but we haven't even seen the actual report yet. What are you trying to do? Why are you trying to pre-spin this? It was a very Bill Barr type moment. And, most reporters didn't fall for it, and we waited till the actual report came out, which turned out to be much more damning than the State Department's attempt to spin it. And that was, to me, that was a sign that they were very nervous about the findings of the report.
Okay, so let's move to the other bucket of issues that Unihal had identified that, maybe could have been the reason that Secretary Pompeo wanted President Trump to fire Steve Linnick. And that was this question of the use of State Department resources, official resources, by Susan Pompeo. There's a lot here. And so help us sort through it. I identified, maybe three categories. One is the Madison dinners. Another is travel, trip with the Secretary of State by Susan Pompeo to the Middle East. And then there's a more general question about sort of use of staff resources for taskings from Susan Pompeo. So, Nihal, can you just walk us through those and sort of what you know about them and how those have, been resolved or not?
Definitely. The first thing to bear in mind is that Pompeo is an up-and-coming Republican, very political, former Kansas congressman, and he wants to have a political future. He's eyeing a future run for the presidency, possibly the Kansas governorship. So he has a potential future, and for that he needs people, he needs exposure, he needs allies, fundraisers, that sort of thing. He needs that sort of thing. So everything he does needs to kind of be looked at in that context, because it kind of explains perhaps some of the unusual moves. So there have been concerns ever since he took over that he and his wife have done certain things that seem more to benefit them politically and personally than, for any diplomatically legitimate reason. There are a number of things. The Madison dinners is an example. This is a dinner that they held pre-pandemic, roughly once every month or every other month. And what would happen is the idea was, they would showcase the State Department, but they would invite people from really all walks of life. And there would be only maybe one diplomat there, aside from Pompeo himself. It might be like some ambassador from a small country or something. But everybody else would be like, I mean, literally their potential guest list included Clint Eastwood. Like, it was like, you know, you name it. I mean, all sorts of people would get invited to these dinners. And, you know, there was these dinners took a lot of staff time. They took a lot of taxpayer dollars. And so a number of State Department employees started to ask what these were really for, because there wasn't even much discussion of foreign policy. And they were just starting to think that this perhaps was a way for Secretary of State Pompeo to build a political base. And full disclosure, I should say, Politico's owner, Robert Allbritton, did attend one of these dinners. I did not know that prior to doing my reporting on this stuff, but I just wanted to give that out there as a disclosure. Secondly, there was the travel. You know, the secretary travels all over the world, and Susan Pompeo, his wife, who is a critical partner for Pompeo in his political life, has been for years. She has often traveled with him. And, you know, this raises some eyebrows, and the question of whether it's legal or not, it's questionable, but it does require staff time. It does require people to, you know, work to help her as she's doing this kind of travel with him. It's also pretty unusual. It's not unprecedented. George Shultz's wife traveled with him when he was Secretary of State, but it is somewhat unusual. And so that has raised some concerns.
Can I just stop you there for 1 second? Because, and just, you know, I want to paraphrase, you know, sort of push back on this that I've read and heard, including from Pompeo himself, which is, you know, look, Susan Pompeo, she is a person who's dedicated to the public mission. She's basically giving her time to do this. She's energetic. She's competent. She cares about the mission of the State Department. She has something to give here. You know, just because the sort of more recent secretaries of state, like Hillary Clinton's spouse, Bill Clinton, who, you know, was sort of a special category, John Kerry's spouse, Teresa Hines Kerry, didn't seem particularly sort of interested maybe in doing all this stuff. But you know, that's neither here nor there, because Susan Pompeo is here and she's energetic and there's nothing wrong with that. What do you make of that kind of response to these criticisms?
I think it's a fair reaction. I've been including a lot of those responses in my stories. I mean, Pompeo calls her a force multiplier. She's been able, and you know, I have documents for emails from her in which she's pointed out that she's been able to get access to people like the wives of certain foreign leaders that the U.S. doesn't normally get access to. I mean, there are definitely arguments in favor of having her do this. Now, I think part of the reason people were concerned was, you know, she did this, for instance, during the government shutdown, right? When staffers were not even getting paychecks. So people felt like it was inappropriate. Recently, she traveled with Pompeo during the pandemic. And so people are like, wait a minute, you know, why are we doing this when there's an added risk to having an extra person? Look, there's a lot of gray areas on some of this stuff. Scott can probably answer that even better than I can. But yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a very legitimate question, but it also makes me wonder if there isn't something bigger that we're just missing. The last thing is, you know, the use of staff for personal errands. I mean, some of the stuff we're hearing is like, you know, they ask staff to pick up their adult son at the airport. They ask staff to get their laundry for them. There could be additional things that they've had asked staff to do that perhaps staff were not happy with. It's a question of whether it's a good idea to use the resources this way, to use people's time this way. One other thing I want to point out too, and I don't know exactly where this is in the investigation or if it is in the investigation, but I recently reported on some questions around their housing. Secretary Pompeo requested military housing. He wanted to live on some sort of a base. And a Navy lawyer raised like legal objections to it. I mean, the lawyer's objections included saying, you know, the fact that the State Department is even wasting it or using any time to look into what should be this personal matter for the secretary, they could be violating laws by doing that. Like, that was one of the objections raised. Nonetheless, despite these objections, the Army gave the secretary a house on a base, Fort Myer, and he is paying rent. They won't tell us how much, but, you know, he probably displaced an Army officer in taking this house. And so there's serious questions like, was this an appropriate use of taxpayer resources? when, you know, this house could have gone to someone who was in line and was definitely more legally eligible for it. So these are just some of the examples that, you know, this investigation is looking into or maybe looking into. Look, I don't know if it's the type of thing where you can ultimately find a smoking gun. Seriously. My understanding is they're still kind of at the early stages. They still have a lot of work to do. But, you know, are they going to find like something that's clearly a violation of some law, or is it just going to be some gray area with policies and, you know, acts that nobody ever enforces? I don't know. And it's going to be really interesting to follow.
Yeah. I mean, I was a State Department lawyer for 10 years and for a substantial portion of that time advised on the use of funds appropriated to the State Department. And just to share sort of my own, you know, assessment, I can absolutely see discomfort with the use of State Department funds for example, you know, travel for Susan Pompeo or, you know, to fund staff time for personal tasks, because I mean, there are no funds that are appropriated for the spouse of the Secretary of State for that person's use. All of the money has to come from other sources, and all of the funds at the State Department are appropriated for specific purposes that have to be justified. There's no sort of like general pot of money for the State Department. So as I read it, and Scott, maybe you can weigh in, it does seem like the discomfort is around, you know, the pretty onerous restrictions on how State Department funds can be used. It seems like they tapped the representation funds to pay for some of this in her sort of representational capacity. But nonetheless, I can see why there would be discomfort and yet efforts to find ways to sort of fit this activity into legally allowable uses of funds.
Before Scott says something, you know, let me just quickly add one other thing. The thing about Susan Pompeo's involvement is that it's not just, you know, the occasional trip or anything. She is really, really involved on a number of fronts, including, you know, with the protocol office, the sorts of gifts that are given, meetings with ambassadors' wives. Like, she's involved to the point where people at the department complain to me that they feel like she's in their chain of command, even though she doesn't actually work there. Right? So this is their complaint, is they're like, look, if we don't follow her instructions that she sends from her Gmail accounts, we're worried that we could be fired. So it's not just somebody who shows up now and then. Like, they feel like she's a constant presence and that it's inappropriate because she's not an employee of the State Department, yet she acts like she is.
I'll second, you know, Margaret, your sense of that. And I will say that, you know, I think I can put myself in the shoes of somebody working in the department around these people, as I have been in the past, and it would make you uncomfortable, and you understand that. And the challenge here, though, consistently with these ethics rules and with other rules about standards of treatment of employees that don't rise to the level of, you know, certain legal protections that are in place for civil servants, things like that, is that it really relies upon the leadership to take the rules seriously and to take action that is corrective. When you get complaints about ways monies may be used that are interpreted one way or the other, you can start congressional investigations. You can trigger different sorts of pushback. But ultimately, all those things are kind of indirect enforcement mechanisms that ultimately come down to the idea of the shame that you're supposed to be feeling if you're invoking some of these things kind of inappropriately. And the IG is supposed to be there to play that role of the transparency enforcer, of bringing these things to the fore and making it so that the risk of exposure and feeling shame is real for people like the Secretary of State, and therefore they have an incentive to enforce the rules. But when you see those institutions being taken away, or you see people aren't worried about the political ramifications, or don't think people care enough for there to be political ramifications, then a lot of these guidelines begin to break down a little bit. And it can make it really hard to distinguish what's right and what's wrong in a lot of different areas, and very difficult to be a good faith civil servant trying to do your job in a way that you find comfortable and that you think complies with what your understanding of your ethical obligations is.
There's also an element of hypocrisy when it comes to Pompeo. When he was a Kansas congressman, he was one of the loudest, like, most demanding people on the Hill when it came to demanding accountability at the State Department, especially on issues like Benghazi, the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, he raked Hillary Clinton over the coals for so many different things, insisting that they hand over information, all this stuff. And now when it comes to these congressional investigations, and for all I know, possibly the IG investigation, you know, he is not cooperating on handing over documents, data, allowing people to testify. They have stonewalled at pretty much every turn. And so it's interesting, these Democrats keep talking about launching an investigation, but if you have, you know, a person that you're investigating that literally just will not allow himself or his institution to cooperate with you or give you anything, how do you investigate? And it's just so strange because, my God, if the Pompeo of, like, you know, 2012 could see the Pompeo of 2020, like, they're like, it's totally, totally not what, you know, not what he was like back then.
And so just keying off of that, Nehal, I want to move to the status of sort of the interactions between the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the State Department, in particular with respect to, well, there's two really, right? I mean, one we know all about. That is the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Elliot Engel is the chairman of that committee. In the context of the Ukraine scandal and impeachment, he had subpoenaed documents related to that as part of that investigation. The State Department handed over zero documents. The administration in general handed over zero documents and never have. You know, fast forward to the investigation over on the Senate side by Republicans, Senator Grassley and Senator Johnson, into, you know, these sort of related issues of Joe Biden's time in the Obama administration, his son, Burisma, all of this stuff that sort of came up in the context of the impeachment investigation. And, you know, my understanding is from reporting is that on the Senate side from Republicans, they've sort of sent requests over to the State Department for information about Biden and Burisma. And there's been no need for subpoenas or anything. The State Department has just provided those documents. When the House Foreign Affairs Committee then said, well, you know, can you please give us those documents as well? The answer was no. So just keying off this sort of politicization question, Nehal, is my summary of sort of what has happened with the House Foreign Affairs investigation right? And what kind of color can you give us on that?
So, yes, you described it fairly accurately. You know, Pompeo has been very responsive to Republican requests for information and has been completely unresponsive to Democratic ones, especially when it comes to information that could damage the opponent of President Donald Trump in this year's election. I mean, it very much, you know, shows the kind of partisanship that he is displaying in this position that is supposed to be nonpartisan. You know, what's fascinating about it, I mean, a couple of things. Like, you know, when the impeachment was happening, people would ask him, hey, like, why are you guys not handing over information to the investigators? And his response was always, oh, we're completely cooperating fully as the law requires. Okay. So he always used this phrase, as the law requires. Now, let's not forget, Pompeo, as I am told a million times, is, you know, number one in his class at West Point and Harvard law graduate. So, you know, supposedly a super smart guy. And this shows a certain level of cleverness because clearly he is interpreting the law in ways that many other people would not interpret the law. And so he's been asked about this, you know, but generally speaking, he just blows this type of stuff off. And another thing that I think is important in this is, you know, when you have people who are caught up in this, people who are career Foreign Service officers, who in theory work for any administration, regardless of the party that controls the White House and are doing so in a nonpartisan way. I mean, you really have to ask yourself, are you crossing lines if you are willing to, you know, go along with this idea of allowing the Secretary of State or, you know, facilitating the Secretary of State's decision to help one party and not help the other? And, you know, there are people, there are career diplomats and staffers who are caught up in this, and the choices they're making are really going to be interesting to watch.
And so just to give a little specificity, I was in preparation for this podcast, I was looking at some of the letters that have gone back and forth between the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Elliot Engel, and the State Department. And one of them I found really striking. It's from this month, from August 7th of 2020, where essentially it's from the State Department, in particular the Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Legislative Affairs, which is the typical person who would send a letter back to Congress in response to Elliot Engel's subpoena for the documents that had already been provided to the Republicans in the Senate. It's fascinating because the letter basically says, no, we're essentially not inclined to respond to this subpoena because of, you know, and it cites, and this is kind of legal, you know, how you talked about sort of the use of the legal question. Yeah. It cites the Trump v. Mazars, the Mazars opinion by the Supreme Court, which, you know, says that a congressional subpoena is valid only if it is related to and in furtherance of a legitimate task of the Congress. The subpoena must serve a valid legislative purpose. It must concern a subject on which legislation could be had. And so it essentially uses the Mazars opinion as a reason to essentially not provide these documents, which this letter says, because the House Foreign Affairs Committee's investigation is for political purposes and not for valid legislative purposes somehow. So it's actually, you know, Scott, you and I have talked about sort of what would the Mazars opinion kind of do to this relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch when it comes to investigations. And, you know, I think here we see an example of the executive branch, you know, essentially using it as a shield, using that Supreme Court opinion as a shield to not provide documents. So, you know, Scott, do you have any thoughts on that or sort of views about how this sort of turns out going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's right. You're absolutely right. They are using it as a shield. But I also am not sure that means necessarily that this is a capacity that Mazars gives them greater than they would have been able to do otherwise. You know, their arguments going into Mazars is that a lot of these, you're kind of extrapolating because Mazars was a differently situated subpoena, but I think you could extrapolate that a lot of the arguments they made in that case, here they would preside a whole litany of reasons and parade of horribles as to why they wouldn't have to comply with something like this. They're tying it to Mazars because Mazars had that specific language, but then Mazars also says where subpoenas do check the requisite boxes, it's appropriate for courts to enforce them. Now, does that help in the immediate term to get immediate response to these subpoenas? No, it probably doesn't, because litigation takes a long time, particularly in this case. It's clear the courts really don't want to rule on this and take their sweet time in hopes that the parties will reach some sort of resolution instead. But the threat is still out there, hanging out there, that the administration is actually going to have to defend those positions in court, and a court may disagree that, in fact, this does not meet that requirement of a legitimate legislative purpose or whatever barriers they're putting in, because the Supreme Court has now said that's appropriate thing for courts to pass judgment on eventually, even if they don't do it so at a very quick pace. And perhaps more importantly, like, Mazars doesn't actually take any other tools away from the Congress that it already had, that I can think of anyway. So I'm not sure it actually puts the Congress in a worse position, but it does put in a different strategic context that we're now going to see the two sides operate around. And that is one that's going to involve the vocabulary of Mazars, certainly.
Yeah, I technically agree with you. I would just share, and this is sort of the interviewer giving some, pretending for a moment to be a guest, but, you know, I would just share, like, when I was in the executive branch, we faced this question of, you know, requests coming from Congress all the time. And the question that we were told to ask ourselves as the lawyers sort of reviewing the requests from Congress is, do you think that this request is something that the president of the United States would invoke executive privilege to hold back? And that presented like a really, really high bar for us at the State Department. That was sort of the operating principles around which we produced documents to the Hill, et cetera. Now it seems this creates a totally different atmosphere where it would seem the question that the Pompeo State Department and the Trump administration is asking is, you know, can you make some kind of an argument that the request doesn't serve a valid legislative purpose, which is quite a different question. So just an observation sort of going forward. Okay, last topic. This is a quick one. I felt we needed to cover it. I have written about this topic. Nahal, you have written about this topic. Over a year ago, the head of the protocol office of the State Department left sort of abruptly, and it was clear at the time that there were allegations regarding improper behavior that he engaged in at the State Department, including, apparently, among other things, carrying a whip around the office. And Scott, you know, this reminded me of a podcast you and I did with Colin Lynch and Robbie Gramer about a year ago, where, you know, we were really talking about the accountability in the department when it comes to sort of political appointees behaving badly. And this is in that vein. Nihal, you wrote on this. Can you just kind of give us an update on what the most recent information we have about this particular case?
Yeah, I broke the story a few weeks ago. You know, the original protocol office chief was pushed out after there were reports that he was abusive to staff and the allegations involving a whip and that sort of thing. But in the months afterward, people complained that other political appointees in that department didn't do enough to protect them from him, and that their own behavior, some of their own behavior, was highly questionable. So the Inspector General's office looked into this. They talked to a lot of people, according to the report that I saw, and they, you know, had a lot of very common complaints, including just this idea that these people should have reported a lot of this stuff to human resources, and that they didn't, and that people felt like they had been treated badly as a result. So they have this report, but the reaction of the department, as in Pompeo's people, was to essentially chide the Inspector General, saying that their report was not good, not thorough, that it relied, I mean, in some cases, they flat out mischaracterized what the report did. They said that it relied on like one source when actually it relied on, you know, many sources, that sort of thing. What the aides to Pompeo also did was they included a reply from two of the people that were singled out in the investigation. And this was a long reply with a lot of details, you know, essentially saying things, giving more context that in some cases seem mitigating. For instance, saying, look, the whip wasn't like a thing that, you know, the guy brought in on his own. It was a gift from a Kazakhstani delegation. You know, there was a reason it was in the office, that sort of thing.
Like you say whip, I say riding crop.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was the other thing. Like they were like, it was a riding crop. And it was just these little things that, but if you read the whole thing, you see that there's a lot of contradictions as well. But ultimately, the bottom line was that the department essentially told the IG, you know what? We don't care. These two, like we talked to them, they're going to be fine. Nobody's going to get punished further. And you guys need to do a better job on your reports. And it was just part of this pattern of tension between the front office of the State Department and the Inspector General's office. And just another example of people not being held accountable. There have been several Inspector General's reports, you know, pointing to poor behavior by political appointees, and none of them have really been punished in any meaningful way. More recently, the ambassador to the UK was accused and investigated by the IG for all sorts of alleged, you know, comments and bad things that were misogynist, you know, racist, that sort of thing, allegations. And the secretary basically said, you know what, he watched the video, reconsider this over, we're not doing anything more. And so it was another example of career staffers going to, you know, the Inspector General, hoping that they can get some accountability, you know, because of these, some of these political appointees, and there being really no accountability. So it's not a good signal to send your workforce.
Okay, so I want to end with a question, which I'm going to give each of you an opportunity to respond to, which is, you know, just looking at the whole landscape of all of this, we've covered so much here today, and this stuff is, you know, only been happening kind of in the last year. What does it all mean? What does it mean going forward? Are these norms essentially gone, or do they return if, for example, Joe Biden wins and there's, you know, the Republicans retain control of the Senate, or no, don't even retain control, they're just in the minority. Do these norms all, you know, return in a gush if there's a Democratic president from Republicans in Congress, or what? What do you see this meaning for so the future of norms of the State Department that have been in place for a long time that have now been kind of blown through?
You know, I do think it's important to bear in mind that the State Department is an institution that has been in place for a long time, that has been through other very, very difficult periods of its history, including as being the kind of black sheep for other prior presidential administrations, maybe not quite as severe as this one, but not much better, and has survived as an institution and has maintained a lot of norms, at least internally. I think that whether it's from the participation of a lot of State Department personnel in the impeachment proceeding, where they felt a duty to testify in response to a subpoena, even where they'd basically been instructed or strongly advised not to by the administration and didn't really have to, the no punishment was going to come if they didn't, or seemed very unlikely to come, to the people talking to reporters like Nahal and other people we've talked to people coordinating with these inspector general reports and raising very valid concerns. There's a lot of very good people who still very much care about the important work of the State Department and the norms that usually guard it. And I think that's true throughout the federal government. So I think a lot of these norms do have the capacity to come back. The challenge that we face is that these norms can only really exist and exercise power over the most senior people, the political people, where they are attached to political consequences, to naming and shaming, and that shaming resulting in something that hurts those political appointees. And that's really the question here. The Trump administration has acted on the assumption that its base doesn't care and it can get by on its base politically. And that's something that Republicans in Congress have really helped facilitate by not really being too willing, except on a couple of issues, to impose costs and pull them before Congress and otherwise take steps that signal the sort of political costs. But there have been ones where they have done that, and we've seen the administration walk back from those. The real question then is that going to prove true in November? Because I think if the administration suffers a defeat, particularly one of the sort of margins that we're seeing in current polling numbers, then that's going to send a message to future presidential administrations saying, well, maybe people are persuaded around the margins about this, this sort of thing, and those margins add up at a certain point and can be a real liability in election. But that may be an optimistic take. It's also possible that people will look to this and say, no, these don't really matter, meaning that the norms may still apply to the lower level people trying to go about their work who understand why they're important, but we're going to see this recurring problem with higher level political appointees who don't feel invested in that system and see it as an obstacle to their narrower and more myopic political goals, ignoring norms so that they can accomplish those.
We're talking about a lot of diplomats, so, you know, it takes a lot to make diplomats angry, but I got to tell you, I've talked to a lot of angry diplomats, and I think that a lot of people are going to want to see not simply, you know, an assumption that the norms are back in town, but that, you know, people, they want to see people held accountable. I think they're going to want to see very clear messaging from a Biden administration, if there is one, that they understand what these people went through, and that they are going to do things to try to strengthen the institution, you know, whether it's investing in it financially or making some of these norms more into policies in which people are held accountable. I think there are a handful of career employees who are viewed as having cooperated too much with some of the politicals when it comes to the way people feel like they've been mistreated. And, you know, I think some of them, people are going to want to see some accountability. I mean, let's just say some ambassadors may want to get ready to pack their bags and come home, or their nominations might be getting pulled or something. But I don't know. I mean, part of the question is, you know, how far do you go with something like this? I mean, part of the reason that people at the department were so, have been so unhappy is because from the beginning, this administration and its political appointees came in not really understanding the concept of civil servant or foreign service officer, and viewing everybody who, you know, was a career staffer as a deep state threat. So they've been treated like an enemy for like 3.5 years. And they don't like that. They don't like having been treated that way. But so the question then is, like, if you have a Biden administration and it comes in with vengeance in mind, vengeance as opposed to accountability, and that might actually also upset some people as well. So I don't know. It's going to be a very, very fine line, I think, for a Biden administration to walk. And, you know, instead of like punishing people, like recalling an ambassador or whatever, they might want to make moves like perhaps bringing back some of the people who have been pushed out and giving them important positions, or just, you know, sending certain messages out, for instance, saying, you know, we want to be very clear that we're not going to discriminate based on people's ethnicity when it comes to giving certain jobs. That was one of the IG reports that came out quite a while back, that in which you know, led to no accountability for the political appointees who were accused in it. And so these are some of the examples. I just think it's going to be a tough line, you know, but I really do feel like people are going to be frustrated if you have a Biden administration that pretends nothing happened these last few years.
Nihal Tusi and Scott Anderson, thank you so much for coming on the Lawfare podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Don't forget to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo Studios was our audio engineer. As always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.